Hey, you just got Rickrolled. This is Paul Douglas Boyer from the Mad Men Machine, show number 104 for end of March, beginning of April. We are helping you find the lost decade right here.
We're no strangers to love. You know the rules, and so do I. I've still commitments while I'm thinking of. You wouldn't get this from any other guy. I just want to tell you how I'm feeling. Gotta make you understand. Never gonna give you up.
Oh, that's enough of that. Never going to give up on stocks. According to the Wall Street Journal, the past 9 years have been a lost decade in stocks. Of course, what they're looking at is the S&P 500. Out at the website for the show notes for this show, show number 104, you'll see a comparison chart of the annualized returns, inflation adjusted, for large cap United States stocks for the past 9 years. And compare that to a widely diversified portfolio of index funds, such as the ones put together by our good friends at Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com, their Index Portfolio 100, whereas the annualized return on just large cap was 0.7% for the past 9 years. The annualized return on Index Portfolio 100, again, inflation adjusted, 9.5% for the past 9 years. Every year, you know, annualized performance. That's what you'd get every year on average. With just about the same risk. Large cap risk was 13.8. The index portfolio risk was 14.3. Growth of a dollar of the large cap. At the end of it, you got $1.06. Index portfolio 100, $2.26. So, read the Wall Street Journal very carefully when you see these headlines that are stocks are tarnished by a lost decade. We'll help you find it. So, just got finished reading a novel, quick read, called Full Faith and Credit by James R. Cook. And it's basically a novel about financial collapse. Yeah, you know I've been reading a lot of books about financial collapse recently, don't you? Well, it's very interesting. The book talks about... it starts off with the dollar dropping precipitously against other major currencies. Talks about the rising price of gold and other commodities. Talks about how the housing market bubble collapses and people start foreclosing on their homes. Does this start sounding familiar? And as I got deeper and deeper into the book, I kept checking back for the copyright date on this thing because it must have been written a month ago. But no, this book was written copyright 1999 by James R. Cook. Now, the protagonist of this book is a guy named Richie. Mm-hmm. Coincidentally enough, he's the guy that leverages himself into gold. And of course, he does pretty well, thus the name Richie. Very interesting book. The conclusion of the book is very interesting too. And if you can find a copy of this at your library, I recommend you read it. It only takes a couple sittings to get through the whole thing. But like I say, I kept checking back to make sure the book wasn't just written a month ago. It's so accurate as to what's going on in our markets now with the rising price of gold and house foreclosures and the credit crunch there have among the various banks and investment banks and things. This guy really was able to see what was happening in the market. I'll have a link to it in the show notes for this show. So I did finish that book, Full Faith and Credit, a novel. Other books on my bookshelf that I'll be reading. One book I just got in the mail and I'm starting to dig in. I've mentioned this to you on the show before. It's The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. It's a story about the Federal Reserve. Now, I don't know why I'm so interested in this and what will happen once I learn all about the Federal Reserve. I don't know, but I'm reading that, and I'm also got a pretty good book, The Dick Davis Dividend. Big book, a wide-ranging book on investing. I think he covers about every investing philosophy in there, including both active and passive investing. And he's got a big chapter on lazy portfolios that I'll be reporting to you on soon. Some of the lazy portfolios that he covers, I have not covered before, so I'll be bringing those to your attention. Also got a copy from Andrew Horowitz of his book, The Disciplined Investor. Going to be spending some time looking through that. I'd like to get him on the show at some point, talk about it. I got a copy from the library of Burton Malkiel's book on China investing, Wall Street to the Great Wall. Also got from the library a book that I had on reserve for a while, finally came in, Gold, the Once and Future Money. Looking forward to reading that. And just in case, I'm also reading another fiction book called Lucifer's Hammer by Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. I don't know if you know what Lucifer's Hammer is all about, but I'll report that to you soon. Now all I need is the time to read them. Let's pull something out of the Madman Machine tool crib. Well, I had it on my outline program this week that I was going to do a tool from a website called I Got Kramered. And this is one of those social networking sites where you can put in your comments of how you bought a stock that Jim Cramer recommended and how much money you lost in doing so. So I went out to check the website. Matter of fact, let me just type it in right now. I got Kramered. Press enter. Loading. Ah, it says this website is coming soon. If you're the owner of this website, you have not uploaded or incorrectly uploaded your website. So it looks like I got Kramered. So instead of doing that tool this week, what I'll do is another sort of tool for you, and this one's for you and your kids. You can go out to newyorkfed.org/education, and you can order from them some comic books that explain the Federal Reserve, yeah, and money. All right, so I'm looking at some now. Here's a comic book called The Story of Banks. Here's another one called The Story of Checks and Electronic Payments. Here's one, A Penny Saved, Why and How We Save and How Saving Helps the U.S. Economy. These sound very fascinating, I'm sure, to you as comic books. The Story of Foreign Trade and Exchange. Too Much, Too Little. The Story of Monetary Policy. And on the cover of this comic book, they have a large boardroom table with flags in the background and people all sitting around the table discussing monetary policy. You can imagine how interesting these comic books must be. Here's one called Once Upon a Dime. Here's one, The Story of Money. This one is The Story of the Federal Reserve System. I should read that one to you sometime on the podcast. And here's one, The Story of Inflation. And so I got into this. I started reading the one on the story of inflation just a little bit ago. And I was expecting them to just basically talk about, increased demand for commodities and decreased supply and how that causes prices to go up and so forth. And that does, for the first six pages or so, first six or ten pages, that's what it talks about. But it does, way down deep into the comic, it does talk about how the cause of inflation is, the answer is that inflation results when there is too much money and credit around in relation to the amount of goods and services. By money, we mean cash in circulation and the amounts that people and businesses can have in bank accounts. Credit refers to the amounts that banks and other lenders have lent. When people have more money to spend and the volume of goods and services doesn't increase as fast, sellers find they can raise their prices and sell as much as they did before. So that's what causes inflation, having more money. And so you can get all of these comic books. Let's see, let me count up how many I have. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I've got 10 comic books from the New York Fed. I want you to guess how much they cost to get to my home, including shipping and everything. No, lower. Keep guessing. Lower. No. No, lower. That's right. Zero. They were free. I don't recall even paying shipping, but I might be wrong about that. I know if you go to the website, though, you can click and say, order this comic, order that comic, order the other comic, and there's no charge for the comics, at least. Maybe there's a nominal fee for shipping. So that's the tool in the Madman Machine Tool Crib this week. The New York Fed comic book series on the Federal Reserve System and money. Like all the other tools I've given you so far, this one's free. This show is proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com, and Mark Hebner, the president of Index Funds Advisors, has written a fantastic book called Index Funds, the 12-Step Program for Active Investors. Seriously, active investors, it's like an addiction. It's like an addiction that other people have to other things or substances or to gambling. So is the same for active investing, trading stocks, trying to beat the market. This 12-step program carefully goes through why active investing does not beat passive investing in the long run. This is the third month, and I'm going to play for you the musical interpretation of step three, stock pickers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. A 12-step program for active investors. Step 3. Stock pickers. My name is Paul, and I'm an active investor. So I'm watching TV the other day trying to get some stock tips, and this guy comes on and tells me how high my stocks should be. Hey, Mr. TV guy, why don't you ever tell us what your long-term stock picking performance is? I don't know the secrets you keep, but I know where you hide. You see, I don't trust this feeling I get from him. But I still watch it, and I know I'll get by, I hope. I just can't tell which of their stock picks are right from wrong, even at the best of times. You know, you can get so enchanted with all their cunning lies. I'm really starting to think it's a babbling of fools.
I don't know the secrets you keep, but I know where you hide. I don't trust this feeling I get. Yeah, but I'll get by. I can't tell right from wrong at the best of times. One can be so enchanted with all your cunning lies. Babbling of fools.
Stock pickers are active investors who bet they can beat a market by picking stocks they believe will outperform an index or market average. The chances of a fund manager beating a market over the long term are about the same as betting on one number on a roulette table in Vegas, or about 1 in 38. On average, stock pickers will always lose by an amount equal to their costs and expenses. If you think you or anyone else can beat the market over the long term, if you are a stock picker, we're here to rescue you. We're here to bring you home.
Is there somewhere you can rescue me?
As a service to you, the listener, I keep track of some of the stock picks of some of the pundits on TV. So at the beginning of 2008 on Fox Business Channel, they had a panel of experts, and they asked each one of the experts to pick a stock for 2008. And Gary B. picked Bank of America. Tobin Smith picked EMCOR, E-M-K-R. Pat picked American Express. Scott picked Martech Biosciences. And Patricia picked Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan. So what would you have done if you invested equally 20% in each one of these five stocks up until this point, up until the 24th of March, I guess we'll put it, you would be down 9.63%. In particular, Tobin's pick of EMCOR, you would have lost 56.9% of your money. American Express down 8.5%, but the other three are slight winners. Martech Biosciences is up 7.8%, Bank of America up 4.6%, Potash up 4.8%. But the thing about this is the risk that you take to get that horrible return is itself horrible. Just invest in a broad basket of index funds across the globe. Don't worry about picking individual stocks. So I was listening to the No Agenda podcast that Adam Curry puts on in conjunction with John C. Dvorak. And the last one, John Dvorak mentions, he likes to go to the dollar store to the dismay of his family. He said he bought a pair of knives, too, for a dollar. And they were every bit as good as the knives you find in the high-end kitchen store, you know, where you pay 1,000% more. But so I was inspired. We used to go to the dollar store a lot because we'd find some good stuff there. And we haven't been going recently. And just after our run to Costco yesterday, I said, let's go to the dollar store. And it turned out we ended up spending about $22, meaning we bought about 22 things. And got Harley Davidson brand beef jerky for a dollar, 3.25 ounces. I've seen this in the grocery store for, you know, $5. Bought a lighter for my candles, bought a pair of sunglasses, all kinds of good stuff. I just wonder what's going to happen, though, if we continue to have a slipping dollar against the Chinese currency, the renminbi, and if China decides to unpeg from the dollar and we get a larger decline of the dollar from the Chinese currency. Wonder if the dollar store will go the way of the Motel 6. Do you remember Motel 6? As I recall, when Motel 6 first came out, what that number meant was $6 a night. Yeah, Motel 6, that meant $6 a night. There was also a Motel 8 around that time. I'm sure it was the upscale version of Motel 6. It was $8 a night. Well, pretty soon, of course, Motel 6 had to raise their prices. And I guess they just kept the number. I wonder if that's what's going to happen to the dollar store. I know some dollar stores you go in and things are not a dollar anymore. But ours is. Dollar Tree, everything's a dollar. And it's absolutely amazing that they can make any money off this stuff. So there's an article in the March edition of the New Yorker. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. The article is entitled Penny Dreadful, by David Owen, and he goes into the notion of, he says, they're horrid and useless. Why do pennies persist? He gets into the article. They talk about back in November of 1989, they introduced a bill called the Price Rounding Act. The purpose was to phase out the penny by requiring that all cash transactions be rounded to the nearest 5 cents. And the bill was opposed by the Americans for Common Sense Zinc guy, producer. Always somebody has a special interest in these bills, don't they? And of course, the flaw in the whole thing is they wanted to round it to 5 cents. They should be rounding it to 10 cents by simply dropping a decimal place. And you don't need a law to round prices to the nearest decimal place. All you need to do is stop making pennies. Stop making nickels. If you find that customers don't have pennies to give you, and you can't get them from the bank, then you're naturally going to round prices to the nearest decimal place, right? I mean, that's what a store would have to do. If they can't get pennies,
because the bank doesn't have any pennies to give them, then they're going to have to round their prices up one decimal place. So you don't need laws to do this. You just need to stop making pennies and nickels and quarters. Just make dimes and half dollars. The last couple of paragraphs of this article say an even simpler solution might be to get rid of 5-cent coins altogether, along with a penny, of course. The idea may not be as radical as it sounds. In 2006, in an initiative called Change for the Better, New Zealand eliminated its 5-cent coins and dramatically reduced the size and weight of its 10, 20, and 50-cent coins. It had already stopped making 1- and 2-cent coins in 1989 and had replaced its $1 and $2 notes with coins in 1991. This total transformation of the country's currency was received with calm pragmatism by most New Zealanders. Even though the lowest denomination coin in the new system, the redesigned 10-cent piece is worth about 8 American cents at the current rate of exchange. Canada, too, has streamlined its currency. It stopped printing $1 and $2 notes, and officials are considering further changes. Last year, economists at Desjardins Group and Associated Canadian Credit Unions published a study that strongly advocated the elimination of the Canadian 1-cent coin, which would most likely be followed by the elimination of the 5-cent coin as well. The study makes many references to the experiences of New Zealanders. It also gets in several digs at foot-dragging Americans. Canada does not have to follow their example. After all, American society is very conservative, particularly with its symbols. For example, the U.S. did not adopt the metric system and has not replaced the dollar bill with a dollar coin. This sort of slur from an alleged ally probably isn't worth going to war over, especially now that its money is sometimes worth more than ours. But we could still strike back by doing Canada and New Zealand one better. We could get rid of dimes, too. No, that's misplaced. Get rid of pennies, nickels, and quarters. Come on, people, wise up! So there's only two times when you should sell your stocks, right? When you need the money or when you lose your faith in capitalism. Well, the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, Thursday, March 27th, article by Greg Wessel, 10 Days That Changed Capitalism. Officials improvised to rescue markets. Will it be enough? The article starts, the past 10 days will be remembered as the time the U.S. government discarded a half century of rules to save American financial capitalism from collapse. On the Richter scale of government activism, the government's recent actions don't yet register at FDR levels. They are shrouded in technicalities and buried in a pile of new acronyms, but something big just happened. It happened without an explicit vote by Congress, and though the Treasury hasn't cut any checks for housing or Wall Street rescues, billions of dollars of taxpayer money were put at risk. A Republican administration, not eager to be viewed as the second coming of the Hoover administration, showed it no longer believes the market can sort out the mess. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophies. Here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Show 104 is James Grant. James Grant founded Grant's Interest Rate Observer in 1983 after an 8-year stint at Barron's, where he originated the current yield column. He's the author of 4 books on finance and financial history, including 1996's The Trouble with Prosperity. His column in Forbes appears monthly. His television appearances include CBS Evening News, Nightly Business Report, and 60 Minutes. And also I remember him from Lewis Rukeyser's Wall Street. And his newsletter can be found at grantspub.com, but at a subscription fee. Well, I've told you before that one of my favorite TV shows, and this can tell you a little bit about my social life, on Friday nights, 8:30, I think it came on PBS, Lewis Rukeyser's Wall Street. Wall Street Week with Lewis Rukeyser. And one of his regular guests came on about once a month or so, it seemed, was James Grant, and he was always the nerdy-looking guy. He used to always wear a bow tie and had these real nerdy-looking glasses, hair parted on the side. Well, there's a video of him speaking on Bloomberg. Now, he's not wearing a bow tie now. I guess he switched to the regular necktie. which I haven't worn in a long time, by the way. But he's talking about the state of the economy. I've got a link to the entire 15-minute long interview, but let me just play a little snippet of it for you now.
Where do you think that people ought to be putting their money? If you talk a little bit about treasuries, that seems to be a magnet for money recently. What about treasuries? What about gold and the dollar?
A friend of mine is responsible for the wonderful quip that treasuries at these rates of interest constitute a return-free risk.
Return-free risk. All right, that's good.
So something is out of kilter in our credit and monetary world. Treasury yields are knocking on the door of the lows last seen in 2003-2004, 10-year securities yielding 3.5%, much less than the year-over-year rate of depreciation in the purchasing power of the dollar. That's one observation. The second is that the price of gold, having recently been at 1,000, is now 9, whatever it is, 950, 940. One ought to have, at least for the sake of clear thinking about finance, one ought to have a point of view about which one of these asset classes is the more absurdly valued. And the trouble is that I own gold personally, and therefore you ought not to listen to anything I say about it. Gold is the value investor's guilty pleasure. It yields nothing. There's no stream of dividends. You can't value it, P ratio management. But it is a hedge against the depredations of our masters in the Treasury and the Fed. Therefore, I hold it, not knowing what it's going to return, not having any sense of how to value it. Its price is the reciprocal of the world's stock of faith in the person of Ben S. Bernanke and others like him. So I say the Fed is worthy of less credit and confidence, ergo the price of gold, other things being the same, ought to go higher. Thinking that, I am necessarily led to think that treasuries are about as compelling a value as the kind of stuff you find in your hotel minibar. Who'd have thunk it that only a generation after the great holdup of creditors and savers during the 70s that the market again would submit to yields of what they call negative real yields, yields less than the rate of inflation, but the credit market has. People will say, and not indefensively, you can defend this, they say that, look, what you don't worry about it in a credit crisis is inflation. Credit crisis is about the destruction of credit, therefore about the destruction of the capacity of our credit institutions to create new claims on money. Ergo, it is deflationary. And I don't dismiss that argument lightly, but I think that the so extreme and violent is this intervention by the Fed, and so risk fraught is its taking aboard of these mortgage obligations as collateral, that the chances of a disastrous run on the dollar, the chances of a worldwide loss of confidence in this piece of paper of no intrinsic value, those chances have gone up. They never were great. The chances of calamity are never great. But the chances of a dollar-based calamity, I think, are much more insignificant now than they were. This tail risk has moved kind of rather towards the middle of the conversation. So many countries tie their currencies to ours, and these countries, most of them, are suffering a terrible run of inflation. Saudi Arabia reported inflation like 8.7%. It had to cut its interest rate in sympathy with the Fed's cut just to keep its currency, its real, tied to the dollar. So I think that the dollar is becoming a very big problem for them, that is to say our foreign friends who lash their currencies to it, and also to us, people who save and use it. I think the risk over a medium-term horizon, 1-5 years, is a very severe inflation.
So he says gold is a reciprocal of your confidence in Ben Bernanke and people like him. Well, goes back to my prediction at the beginning of this year. One of my 10 predictions was that Ben Bernanke would resign due to wanting to spend more time with his family. In that event, gold should do well. But like Jim says, gold has no earnings, has no dividends, but like he didn't say, it doesn't have a board of directors either. Well, James Grant may be losing his faith in capitalism, but that doesn't mean he can't be our guru. Congratulations, James Grant, you're the guru on Mad Men Machine 104. I'm so glad you joined me this week on the Mad Money Machine Show 104. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes finding the lost decade to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, you know what you need to do. Go visit our sponsor, Index Funds Advisors, at IFA.com. That's right. Point your browser to IFA.com. Take their risk capacity survey. These are risky times. Make sure you are investing according to your risk capacity. Some music on this program provided by music.podshow.com. I would like your feedback emailed to me at feedback@madmoneymachine.com or call the voicemail line 206-734-4763. Make a comment in the show notes or see me on Twitter, Mad Money Machine.